Hi, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA. We all love great stories. And great stories are what we pride ourselves in delivering to you every week. Latino USA presents a mix of reporting on culture and politics, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues, featuring stories that will make you think and maybe even inspire you. Listen to Latino USA on your favorite podcast app from PRX.
Demand for quartz countertops is booming, but they're leading to a deadly disease among workers.
The key message here is that this is a preventable workplace illness that needs to be taken very seriously to not let another generation be told that they're going to die just for turning up to work.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, Raqqa was once the capital of the ISIS caliphate. The brutal group is no longer in charge, but civilians are still scarred.
Even when they left the memory of them to many people, they still haunted them in their dreams, like nightmare.
Plus, NASA puts its best minds to the test on moon time.
It would be fair to say that time flows differently. Actually, that would be the technical as well as the poetic way to say it.
More poetry and, you know, news are ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. In the early 2000s, a new engineered stone hit the home improvement market. Designers and home renovators went nuts for it.
Today, we are going to talk about the trend of quartz countertops.
Everybody loves quartz.
Hey, guys. In today's video, y'all, I'm going to share with y'all my newly installed quartz countertops, and then we'll jump right into styling them.
Quartz. Today, those countertops are in millions of homes around the world. The global market is worth more than $23 billion and is expected to nearly double in less than a decade. That's because there is a lot to like about quartz. It's pretty, it's durable, it's low maintenance. But the workers who make, cut, and install the counters are coming down with a deadly lung disease called silicosis. Cases have been reported from China to Spain, from Australia to the United States. And clinicians say this is just the tip of the iceberg. Over the next 3 days, we'll be reporting on how this has happened and what some countries are doing to try to protect workers. Today, we start in Turkey, at the beginning of the supply chain. The world's Duri Buscarin traveled to a town known for its natural quartz mines where workers have been falling sick.
In the town of Çine, where Şenol Gürgün lives, it seems just about everyone works in the quartz industry. Every time there's a controlled explosion to unearth the stone at the mine nearby, the dust carpets his neighborhood. I live in nature, and I can't even smell the pine trees, he says. The hills of Çine are full of white quartz. After they're mined, the stones are crushed into smaller pieces, almost like sand, and mixed with a resin to create that smooth, uniform slab that you see in so many kitchens. Through a translator, Gürgün says he spent years operating the machine that poured that composite quartz out so it could be shaped.
The area where we were working, it was really dense with the particles, and they wouldn't open the windows. Like, we were working indoors the whole time, and the whole area was really, it was closed. It was just closed.
Each worker, he says, received a filtered face mask every 6 months. But one by one, Gürgün's co-workers from that unit started to fall sick. Three in 1 year alone. They were diagnosed with silicosis. Growing up in Çine, he had seen it before, when a neighbor got sick and died within a year.
Then I saw how he literally melted in nearly less than a year. Like, for one moment, he was looking okay, just like you, like a normal, healthy person. And within a year, going to the hospital, coming back home, he passed away.
There is no cure for silicosis. As crystalline silica dust builds up in your lungs, it causes scarring and it gets harder to breathe. And so when Gürgün started to feel sick, he knew what was coming.
Feels like as if my meat is leaving my bones.
By 2016, Gürgün could no longer work. Today, he's 47 years old and weighs just 100 pounds, his limbs impossibly thin, his eyes sunken like those of a prisoner of war. His wife, Julia, says they traveled to another city to get a medical report that would give him a formal diagnosis and allow him to receive a disability pension from the government. But it barely covers the cost of food and medicine for their daughter, who has a disability of her own. It's incredibly distressing, she says. Workers like Jürgen feel forgotten by their former employers, by the government, whose rules didn't protect them. Turkish labor law requires factories to undergo regular health and safety inspections, but former employees in Çin allege that their managers would tamper with air quality monitoring equipment to hide how bad things were. Managers would get tipped off when inspectors were coming, and only then would they open the windows, workers say. We reached out to several mines and the Turkish Ministry of Labor to comment on this story. None of them responded to repeated requests. At least a dozen companies create manufactured quartz here in Çin. Ahmet Uslu, a local environmental activist, points them out as we drive by. He says his organization helps more than 100 workers suffering from silicosis, men who can no longer work. But about 6,000 people work in the industry here, he says, and could develop it later. The companies take regular scans of the workers' lungs, but they don't share the results with the miners, he says. That way they can fire them, he says, before they have a formal diagnosis. After 7 or 10 years of working in a mine, you're almost guaranteed to get it, Uslu says. This is what happened to Saim Unal. Today, he lives on a bit of land outside of Çin. He and his wife Fatime tend olive trees and a vegetable garden. They keep chickens and sheep, which he shows off proudly. Scattered around the property are small white stones, the same ones Unal spent 16 years sorting in the mines. When the mines first opened, the job paid little more than minimum wage, Unal says, but he took it because it offered health insurance. Unal says that after a 10-hour shift, his boss would call him and say someone couldn't come into work, so he'd have to go back and work another 6 hours. They didn't want to stop the factory line. The harder we worked, they wanted more, he says. They worked us like slaves. And after they realized we were no good for them anymore, they threw us away. When Unal was diagnosed with silicosis in 2012, he says, his company laid him off. He says he applied for workers' compensation, but he's been in a legal fight with the company for the past 10 years. In its defense, he says, the company brought witnesses and submitted pictures taken of him at work, saying he didn't wear a protective mask. I know people who are even sicker than me, Unal says, who have never spoken publicly about this, even within the community, because they want their children to have jobs in the mines. Unal's illness has had a slower progression than some of his former coworkers. He can still walk, but he doesn't know how much time he has left. All we want is something that leads to practical legal steps from the government, Unal says. We want to see something that makes these companies responsible for the harm this job is causing. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Çin, Southern Turkey.
Tomorrow, we travel to Spain, where engineered stone first took off. Advances in technology are making stone cutting safer, but for a lot of workers, it may be too late. We know that 54 years ago, astronaut Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon and into history.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But whether we know exactly what time it was when he walked on the moon on that July day in 1969, that is a tougher question, because the clocks we use here on Earth would move just a little more quickly on the moon. And even slight variations in time can make a big difference in space missions where extreme precision is vital. So the White House this week instructed NASA to come up with a coordinated lunar time. Here to explain is Priya Natarajan. She's an astrophysicist at Yale University. Priya, why does time move just a little bit faster on the moon? I know it has something to do with gravity, but can you explain it better?
Right. So I think it might be easier to just take the example of GPS and satellites around the Earth first. So, for example, we have 24 satellites, right, that are orbiting the Earth, and each has an atomic clock. There are two effects that happen that are predicted by Einstein's theory of special relativity and general relativity. First is that clocks that are circling, say, for example, 14,000 kilometers per hour around the Earth, these GPS satellites, they tick a little slower. However, clocks that are about 20,000 kilometers above the Earth, because of general relativistic effects, orbiting at this height, they should tick faster. So there's a compensation that GPS satellites do, right? So because of the movement, they go slower. But then because they're orbiting above, they tick faster. So there's a compensation and there's a net speed up of about 38 microseconds a day. I'm just giving you these numbers to give you a feel for the fact that moving clocks and clocks that are above in the gravitational field will tick slower and faster, respectively. So now let's move to the moon, right?
Okay.
So time ticks faster on the surface of the moon because the moon is moving around the Earth and it is in the gravitational field of the Earth. So the net effect is that the clock ticks faster by about 58 microseconds on the moon. But now if you have a lot of spacecraft to different countries launching operations on the moon, they will need to coordinate with themselves. These people on the lunar surface will need to talk to each other, and they'll then need to talk to satellites, and in turn then talk to us. So there are these, like, you know, various kinds of time compensations that we will need to take into account, and we need to standardize that. And I think that's what the White House has called for now.
So time, as you mentioned, moves only very slightly faster on the moon, 58.7 microseconds per Earth day. And for context, a microsecond is 1/1,000,000th of a second. So why would these tiny, tiny, tiny variations matter?
Oh, they matter because when you convert them into distances, right? So if you want positional accuracy on the moon, you could, for example, end up in Brooklyn rather than Manhattan quite easily with that kind of time difference.
And I understand that the White House has not directed NASA to come up with a different time zone, but actually a whole different system of how time is measured.
Exactly. It will be like, you know, the moon will have its own time zone. It will not be part of the Earth. Just as we have UTC, we have GMT, it will not be part of that. It'll be an entire self-consistent system for the moon itself. For example, you know, the International Space Station, that actually still uses UTC, right? Because it's on low Earth orbit. It's not that far. It's just 250 miles or so above the Earth. But the moon is too far away. So it needs its own self-consistent system. And essentially, it's for coordination of activities on the moon, right? There are many countries that are now aspiring to send rovers, to send humans to the moon, and so on. So they need to be able to talk to each other without delays for precision distance measurements and location.
And what exactly would a new system for keeping track of time be? You know, does that mean atomic clocks on the moon and they just tick at a slightly different pace and then you just have this whole different time system? So it's January on Earth, but December on the moon?
Well, it's not that dramatically different, right, as we saw. But yeah, I think the idea is that you would, just as on Earth, right, we have a lot of these cesium fountain atomic clocks placed at different points on the Earth. I suspect that's what we will be doing. We'll be placing these atomic, high-precision atomic clocks. I mean, these atomic clocks are incredible, right? So they are accurate to one part in 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So it's just incredible, right? And so I suspect there'll be a set of clocks on the lunar surface, placed around the lunar surface, that would be synchronized, just as we have on Earth. But it would be a completely different independent system, independent of the Earth, for example.
And what are the methods of creating moon time? Would it be a whole new system of, you know, a moon hour and a moon day?
Yeah, I suspect this could be a lot of fun, right? Or they could just map it to the Earth day, have the same set of sequences of, you know, days and hours and minutes and seconds and so on. But I think they could also do something really funky, like completely define a new system if they wanted to.
Priya Natarajan is an astrophysicist at Yale University. She's been telling us about NASA's assignment to keep track of time on the moon. The earthquake that hit Taiwan this morning was massive in scale, but the death toll was relatively low. We'll explain some reasons why just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A major earthquake in Taiwan killed at least 9 people and left dozens more trapped in buildings and tunnels. It was the most powerful earthquake to hit Taiwan in 25 years. It struck at around 8 in the morning on Wednesday, local time, when most people were still at home, some just waking up to watch the morning news.
现在呢,发生了有地震的情况,地牛发生。那么现场你们可以看到呢,其实...
That is a local television host staying composed as everything around her shakes violently. The World's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is following the story. Patrick, what is the latest on rescue efforts in Taiwan?
At least 900 people are injured. There are dozens needing to be rescued from under collapsed buildings or vehicular tunnels. Thousands of people, their homes don't have water or power, and it is possible that that death toll will go up as these emergency crews go out there and assess the damage. For now, Carolyn, officials are telling everyone, stay where you are, don't travel, because unfortunately, this disaster is happening right before a really important holiday in the Chinese-speaking world, which Taiwan is a part of.
Patrick, this earthquake was centered off the east coast of Taiwan. Is that where the worst damage has happened?
It hit an area called Hualien. This is a beautiful mountainous area on the coast. But to drive to it from Taipei, the capital, you have to go through these tunnels that are bored through mountains. One of the tunnels is 8 miles long, if you can believe it. And so dozens of people are still trapped in that tunnel system. That area also has windy cliffside roads, again, very beautiful, but a bit precarious. Falling rocks have hit those roads and cut off access. I spoke to a man named Tony Leung. He's a tour guide in Hualien, and he said the damage he's seen is pretty severe.
I am a little bit shocked. The whole road is broken. I think it will take a few years to recover.
And Tony also said while we were on the phone that he was still feeling aftershocks. Those aftershocks are expected to keep coming over the next few days and even weeks.
Patrick, I've been seeing these striking photos of buildings leaning pretty significantly, but also looking quite intact. The death toll also seems to be relatively low, at least so far, for a quake of this size. Are both of those things thanks to good building codes in Taiwan?
In Taiwan, earthquake preparedness is a really big deal. It's at a level we don't see in, say, California. So that's at the commercial level. Some of the buildings you're talking about are tilted at these like 30-degree, almost impossible-looking angles. If you get into talking about people's homes, yes, the government also has oversight there, too. And they'll actually offer a subsidy to people who get their homes checked for earthquake resistance. And if your home looks unstable, they will require you to shape it up.
Wow. So it's looking like good policy in action here. What has the response been so far from Taiwan's neighbors?
Where things get interesting is with China. So China famously claims that it owns Taiwan, even though Taiwan has its own government, its own military. So China sends warships and fighter jets near Taiwan all the time to threaten the island. But today, Beijing is striking a different tone, saying we extend sympathy to our Taiwan compatriots and we are ready to come to the island and help if you request it. I think the odds of this happening are almost zero. The idea of large numbers of boots on the ground for any reason is not very appealing to most Taiwanese people, given the military tension. But it still is an interesting shift in tone from the Chinese Communist Party.
Patrick Nguyen is the World's Asia correspondent based in Bangkok. This week, new legislation known as the hate crime law came into force in Scotland. It's been described as the most controversial law ever to be debated in the Scottish Parliament. The government says the new measure will make Scotland a safer and more tolerant place for everyone. But police unions, some women's groups, and one very well-known writer are not convinced. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
Just hours after the new law came into force on Monday, around 300 people gathered outside the Parliament building in Scotland to make their feelings known.
Shambolic and dangerous. New Hate Crime Act. This act has now been forced upon us in this country.
That's Steph Shaw, one of the protest organisers. The new law, Shaw said, would criminalise free speech. Scotland's First Minister, Humza Yousaf, says that's just not the case.
The only concern you should have is if your behaviour is threatening or abusive and intends to stir up hatred.
The Hate Crime Act will make it a criminal offence to stir up hatred against people on the basis of a number of protected characteristics, including age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, and transgender identity. There's no mention of race because that's already covered under legislation passed in the 1980s. And there's no mention of women.
I am not persuaded that the Scottish government has any interest in promoting women's rights.
Christian McNeill is a writer and former barrister based in Scotland.
I mean, the number of offences against women, you know, from domestic violence to rape to assault to murder is vast in comparison with the number of so-called hate incidents for other groups.
The Scottish government says it's planning to bring in an anti-misogyny law to deal specifically with crimes against women sometime in the future. But McNeill and other women's groups in Scotland are asking why it hasn't already happened. On Monday, Harry Potter writer J.K. Rowling waded into the debate. Rowling, who's been openly critical of trans activists in the past, tweeted that women gain no additional protections under the new law, but trans activists do. The writer went on to post a series of insulting tweets describing several high-profile transgender women as men. Then Rowling dared Scottish police to arrest her. Law experts say what she wrote may be offensive, but it's not a crime.
I don't think it meets the burden of being threatening and abusive and causing fear and alarm to specific individuals.
Nick McCarroll is a senior law lecturer at Glasgow Caledonian University. He says saying something shocking or insulting is in fact protected within the law.
So simply being offended by somebody's comments would not be enough to enter the criminal law. And indeed, you've got the right to be offensive, shocking or disturbing, actually, it says in the law.
McCarroll says he sees the new law as a step forward for Scotland.
Hate crime as a concept is not new in Scots law. So what this act does is it brings it all together in one piece of legislation and expands protection to other groups. There are issues, I think, about implementation, but overall, I think the law is a positive development.
Those implementation issues are what's bothering Scottish police officers right now. More than 3,000 complaints have been made to Police Scotland since Monday. But police officers say they've received just 2 hours of training to get their heads around the new rules. Callum Steele is the former head of the Scottish Police Federation.
For the police officers that are working today, they find the whole approach to police training in respect of this to be, frankly, farcical.
Steele, who was with the police force for 30 years, says officers are already overwhelmed. And he says the law will turn police into sort of glorified playground monitors.
And I'm not sure, in fact, I'm entirely sure that that's not a role the police should be performing.
Last night, Police Scotland said they'd received a series of complaints about J.K. Rowling's tweets. But her comments were not assessed to be criminal, the police said, and no further action will be taken. Meanwhile, the home of Humza Yousaf, the Scottish First Minister who introduced the new law, was spray-painted with abusive comments this week. Scottish police say the incident has been recorded as a hate crime under the new act. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Stick around for more global news. You're listening to The World. 4 men from Tajikistan have been arrested for last month's deadly attack in Russia. Now, Central Asian migrants are reporting increased harassment and xenophobia.
People take back roads in order to avoid traffic police. You don't take trains in Russia. When something like this happens, you don't go outside.
That story and more global news still ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Raqqa in northeastern Syria was briefly the capital of what the ISIS government called its caliphate. The city endured 3 years of unimaginable violence at the hands of ISIS, and then a war with the U.S. and allies to dislodge the Islamic militant group. ISIS no longer controls the city, but as The World's Shirin Jafari reports from Raqqa, recovery happens slowly.
Raqqa is a dusty city, not just because of the desert around it, but because of all the rubble and ruin that remain from the years of fighting. Some things have improved. Roads are open. There are a couple of functioning traffic lights. Shops are back in business. One restaurant offers a delicious makhluba, a rice dish with spices and cooked meat. In January 2014, a group that called itself the Islamic State took over Raqqa and declared the city its capital. ISIS fighters carried out public executions at local stadiums. They shut down schools and universities, and they banned music. ISIS supporters from all over the world descended upon Raqqa with the hope to be part of this grand project of an Islamic State. ISIS ruled in Raqqa through repression, intimidation, and fear. For those who lived here, every corner of this city brings back haunting memories.
He's the bus 6 section.
I meet Shira Al-Muhammad in the basement of the only hospital in Raqqa. The walls of the hospital still bear bullet holes. Some broken windows haven't been fixed, and the hallways are dark because there's a shortage of electricity. Muhammad was 17 years old when ISIS took over her city. Speaking through an interpreter, she says everything changed overnight.
Girls couldn't walk in the streets, and even ISIS killed many children, many adults. So it was very, very terrible, and many of my friends have died.
Muhammad's family fled Raqqa to a nearby village, not knowing if they would ever be able to return. While they were gone, a coalition of countries led by the United States began a campaign to oust ISIS from Raqqa. This was an aerial campaign. For 4 months, American and coalition jets pounded Raqqa from above. ISIS wouldn't let people leave the city. The human rights organization Amnesty International described Raqqa as a death trap. Amnesty later conducted an investigation into civilian deaths and found that the campaign killed and injured thousands of civilians, in some cases wiping out entire families. By October 2017, ISIS was out. Lieutenant General Paul Funk made the announcement.
After 4 years of brutal occupation under the so-called ISIS caliphate, Raqqa, its capital, is liberated.
Muhammad and her family returned to Raqqa.
Everything was destroyed. Every building was destroyed. And even there was mines here.
There were mines everywhere, she says. Some families were killed when they entered their homes. Much of the city was destroyed, including Muhammad's building. Muhammad went to school and studied medical engineering. She now works at the hospital in a section that helps war victims with prosthetics. A lot of her patients are children. To help them regain their movement is the most satisfying thing in the world, she says.
They can't go to schools. And some of them even forget how to walk because it's been since a long time they didn't walk at all. So when we give them the broomsticks, they feel so happy and feel like alive again.
Even though ISIS no longer holds territory, it continues to carry out small attacks in this area. Muhammad says the scars from those days haven't completely healed.
We were so happy that they left, but even when they left, the memory of them terrified many people. They still haunted them in their dreams, like a nightmare.
On a recent windy day, just outside of the city, a group of men sit on the banks of the Euphrates. They're adding cubes of lamb onto skewers for lunch. They tell me they come here every week to let off steam from their jobs as car mechanics. One of them, Muhammad Yunus, says life before the war was beautiful in this city of 500,000 people. Today, he says, there is a new threat to their lives and livelihoods. We're more worried about Turkish attacks than ISIS coming back, he tells me. Turkey, which borders Syria, has been carrying out airstrikes against the Kurds, who govern this northeastern part of the country. Turkey considers them a security threat. Yunus lost his home in Raqqa during the fighting. He says it has taken him years to rebuild. People are slowly picking up the pieces of their old lives, he says. But Raqqa will never be the same. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Raqqa, Syria.
The port of Baltimore continues to be mostly blocked by the tangle of metal that used to be the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And there is a tangle of legal concerns as well. For the victims killed on March 26th for the city of Baltimore, for the owners of the ship, the owners of the cargo, and the crew. And of course, there are the insurance companies. We reached out to an expert on international maritime law to ask about some of this. Jason Chua is a professor of commercial and maritime law. Jason, what was your first thought on March 26 when this cargo ship, the Dolly, toppled the Francis Scott Key Bridge?
I think my first thoughts, rather than my single first thought, were what's going to happen to the families and the relatives of the deceased who were working on the bridge. Then, of course, the seafarers, the crew working on board the vessel, and, of course, the two pilots who were guiding the vessel out of port. Then, of course, being a commercial guy, I also started to fret a little about the scale of the financial costs to insurance companies, to cargo owners, and also to freight companies all over the world, given that this is a very large ecosystem, essentially.
Very large. How will it be determined who will be held liable for the damages here, including the deaths of the workers on the Key Bridge and the destruction of this very expensive bridge itself?
If it is about criminal liability, then essentially it will be about the laws of Maryland and in the United States, which will apply. And of course, the key individuals who are implicated would be the pilots, the ship owner, and perhaps the crew. So that would be from a criminal law perspective. From a commercial law perspective, one would be looking at a greater range of people and individuals and organizations that might be held liable. So, for example, the vessel was carrying 3,000 odd containers. The owners of the cargo held in these containers would, of course, want recourse. They would normally turn to their insurers for compensation. Their insurers would then in turn turn to the insurers of the ship owner, and they will look to paying compensation towards the losses claimed. But of course, the losses would automatically be limited by law. That is to say, there is a cap as to the amount of compensation that could be claimed. And this is a rule under American law as well as international treaty law.
You mentioned a cap on liabilities. I gather that this might be an incident that tallies up into the billions of dollars. What would the liability cap on this accident be?
Roughly speaking, you're looking at a compensation bill that generally should not be larger than the market value of the vessel. So you can see it's quite small, because obviously the bridge is so much more expensive. And of course, there have been lives lost as well. So it's quite a massive loss. But the system of limitation of liability in maritime law is such that there will be a limit on that liability.
So you mentioned that the captain and the crew of the ship might be in some way held legally responsible. I gather they are still on the Dolly going about their duties. What would happen if they were to leave the ship?
So that is largely a matter for American law and law enforcement. Generally speaking, if the ship is arrested, the authorities would also either put the crew on remand, or they will look at taking criminal prosecution action against them. Generally speaking, they would not be able to leave easily. And there will be, as I said, it really depends on the authorities. But in this particular situation, it is unlikely that they would be allowed to leave.
While they are on the ship, are they somewhat protected then?
Not necessarily. So once a ship is arrested, then essentially the ship falls within U.S. jurisdiction, and whoever is on board will also come within U.S. jurisdiction. My concern for the crew, it really is the fact that in many such instances in the past where there had been a maritime casualty, generally speaking, the authorities tend to look to the main human representation of the vessel at port. And of course, that usually would be the crew, and they would detain the crew, and they would take criminal action against the crew. And what is, of course, worrying is that the criminal action can take a long time, because a great deal of investigation has to happen before the evidence files could be properly prepared and presented before a court of law. And all that could take a very long time. But because lives had been lost, it is very unlikely that a U.S. court would grant bail. And that, of course, leaves the crew in a state of limbo because they can't go home. They are stuck in the United States. But there is very little movement as far as the criminal litigation or the criminal prosecution is concerned. So in some instances, we have seen how foreign crew has been kept in a particular jurisdiction following a casualty for years.
I should mention that the captain and crew of the ship are 20 men from India and one from Sri Lanka. Are there any short-term legal steps that can be taken to get the crew, you know, off of that ship?
As far as the crew is concerned, I think much depends on what the authorities intend to do with them. I have a strong feeling that that decision is not likely to happen very quickly because, again, much depends on the gathering of evidence. And so what one does worry for them.
Jason Chua is professor of maritime law at University of Malaya in Malaysia and City University of London. He was helping us understand the legal issues raised by the shipping accident and deadly bridge collapse in Baltimore. Russian authorities detained four men almost immediately after the attack on the Crocus Music Center in Moscow last month. 144 people died and more than 500 others were injured there. The detained suspects are all from Tajikistan, a republic in Central Asia where most people are Muslim. Since the arrests, there's been a rise in reports of xenophobia, harassment, and attacks on Central Asian migrants living in Russia. The World's Daniel Offman reports from Riga, Latvia.
If you speak with people from Central Asia who have spent time in Russia, they'll tell you that this kind of behavior is nothing new.
The discrimination of Central Asian migrants has been there for quite a long time.
This is Bektor Iskender, a Warsaw-based journalist originally from the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan. He says that over the years, he's felt uncomfortable spending time in Russia.
It's always been quite scary for me, to be honest, to travel to Moscow, and I really didn't wish to do that. And I guess it comes mostly from my childhood, because within my family in Kyrgyzstan, there's always been, you know, this fear of being attacked based on the way we look like.
Iskender says those fears are in part based on his firsthand experience. He describes traveling to Moscow and being extensively questioned and searched at the airport.
What amazed me back then was how, I guess, we were racially profiled, because I didn't see any like Russian person being searched like that. It was only Central Asian.
Iskender says police check IDs in the streets or at metro stations, and it would almost always be Central Asians or other minorities. Xenophobia directed at Central Asians has a long history in Russia. Central Asian republics are majority Muslim, so far-right Russian nationalists spread xenophobic messages based on their religion, ethnicity, and their language. However, despite this dynamic, people from Central Asia would often travel to Russia as migrant workers.
Moscow, of course, was the capital of the whole empire, like, you know, the whole Soviet Union. So there was this aspiration to be successful enough to move to Moscow. But on the other hand, you know, you would not feel comfortable in Moscow. And I think people from other republics, they share this a lot.
That legacy of moving to Russia to make a living has carried over to today. According to Russia's Interior Ministry, more than 10 million migrants from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan are working in Russia. One of the reasons for the high number of migrants is because of visa-free travel between some of these Central Asian countries and Russia. Leyla Siedbek is a lawyer from Kyrgyzstan and the chairwoman of a Vienna-based nonprofit called Freedom for Eurasia.
Traditionally, the destination for jobs was Russia. And for many, it actually helped to provide for their families, especially considering that back at home, employment is an issue, especially in Tajikistan. There is a high rate of unemployment.
But now, following the shooting on March 22nd and the arrest of men from Tajikistan, migrants are now concerned about their safety in Russia. In this video posted on social media, a Russian police officer questions a man from Tajikistan who's having lunch at a restaurant in Volgograd in southern Russia. Russian police have conducted more raids of businesses and homes of Central Asian migrants. Malika Bahovadinova is a researcher of Eurasian migration at the University of Amsterdam.
There is this intensification of like migration control. You do more raids, you do more checks, you identify more people, you stop all of the cars if you see that people in the car are phenotypically different.
Bahovadinova says that the most visible change in the authorities' behavior is that they're showing the suspects being tortured.
Of course, everyone, whoever works in the human rights community, perfectly knows that torture is used in law enforcement in the region quite widely. However, in this regard, the public display of this torture was very much new.
The videos sent a chilling message.
Once the images with torture started to come in, it's also tapped into this decades-long trauma, yes, of like what kind of violence can happen to you. So it was quite intense.
People from Central Asia living in Russia are sharing information and warning each other to be careful.
People take back roads in order to avoid traffic police. You don't take trains in Russia. You prefer driving cars. When something like this happens, you don't go outside.
Bahovadinova says that there are fears that the treatment of Central Asians in Russia will further deteriorate. Last week, Kyrgyzstan's government warned its citizens to not travel to Russia. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman, Riga, Latvia.
We've reported in the past on how U.S. intelligence warned the Kremlin of a possible ISIS strike prior to the attack last month. We now know that their warning specified that an attack might target the Crocus Music Center itself. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Are you a fan of Dragon Ball Z, the Japanese anime TV series turned video game? Well, Saudi Arabia might be a future travel destination.
Calling adventurers from across the globe.
Around the world are converging on Saudi Arabia after the discovery of Dragon Balls with wish-granting powers.
To experience an unprecedented, immersive entertainment destination.
That's an advertisement for a Dragon Ball theme park at Qiddiya City, a future entertainment complex. Under Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's crown prince and de facto ruler, places like these are popping up to put forward a new image of the kingdom. Social change in Saudi Arabia was previously thought to be impossible due to the influence of the conservative clerical establishment. So where are those clerics today? To answer that, we're joined by Rehan Ismail. She's a professor of contemporary Islamic studies at the Oxford Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. She joins us from the UK. Rehan, let's talk about how the Saudi monarchy interacted with the clerical establishment before Mohammed bin Salman came around. How much power did these religious leaders have?
So the Saudi clerics, they were significantly involved in the establishment of the Saudi state. That relationship changed significantly with the establishment of the modern Saudi state in 1932 under the leadership of Abdulaziz ibn Saud. Here, he limited the influence of the Saudi religious establishment. And the Saudi religious establishment, or the clerics, were allowed to dictate and control social aspects of Saudi society. So basically, societal evolution took place within the boundaries established by the clerics, but they were not allowed to comment on politics without the permission of the state. And that lasted until the arrival of Mohammed bin Salman, who tried to reform Saudi society and in many ways tried to reform the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia.
So why have these clerics been considered a barrier to social change in Saudi Arabia? Is that just because they kind of had purview over the social sphere while the rulers kept control over politics?
Absolutely. The clerics were known to be more conservative. They adhered to a conservative interpretation of Islam. They're part of the Salafi movement. And the Salafi movement, particularly in Saudi Arabia, is seen as more conservative in their approach to social issues, including women's rights, including minority rights, and so on, which is why the Saudi ruling family, in its effort to transform Saudi society, tried to curb the influence of the religious establishment.
So you mentioned there's been a change under Mohammed bin Salman. He's now using these splashy sports events, architectural projects, and other cultural endeavors to burnish the country's image. Can you describe what role the clerics are playing now? Have they lost a lot of their power over, you know, society?
The clerics continue to maintain their positions. And in Saudi Arabia, members of the religious establishment continue to issue religious rulings. They continue to deliver Friday sermons. What has changed is the relations between individual clerics with Mohammed bin Salman. So at the moment, those who are very supportive of his project and those who are willing to act as his cheerleaders are the ones who have a lot of power in Saudi Arabia. So basically, they're endorsing what the Saudi ruling family is doing. And it is based on their own interpretation of Islam or the Salafi tradition, where loyalty to the state and loyalty to the ruling family is paramount. So some members of the religious establishment are doing quite well under Mohammed bin Salman, while others, if they used to preach, conservative interpretations of Islam, they have gone very quiet. They don't say much about social issues, while others are either in jail or operating in exile.
So overall, is it fair to say that these clerics have less power or influence than they did before MBS came to power?
I would say so. What makes Saudi Arabia seem different under MBS is perhaps the creation and the proliferation of liberalized spaces within the kingdom outside the purview of the religious class. So this doesn't mean that the religious establishment or the religious class has lost its power, but previously they enjoyed more authority to prevent and limit the proliferation of liberalized spaces. But having said that, they really don't have much authority in terms of criticizing the state or criticizing the music industry or criticizing other liberalized spaces in Saudi Arabia.
Do you think that the relationship between the monarchy and these clerics has changed forever, or is this going to last just as long as MBS is in power?
Saudi society continues to view Islam as an important element of their identity, and Mohammed bin Salman himself might change. So everything depends on what's going to happen next. Is he going to be able to deliver? Is his Vision 2030 going to be a successful venture? He might turn conservative himself. So who knows what's going to happen. One thing that I can perhaps predict is the importance of the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia. I think they will continue to be important in Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, it depends on the influence as well. They will maintain their position, but whether or not they're going to be able to influence Saudi society is a different question.
Raihan Ismail is a professor of contemporary Islamic studies at the Oxford Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. She joined us from the UK. All right, college basketball fans, I am not sure how early in the tournament your bracket was busted, but we are now heading into the really big rounds of March Madness. In our newsroom, we noticed how key athletes on the court came from abroad, like Purdue's center Zach Edey.
And then in walks Zach. He like ducks in the doorway, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh, because the Canadian is 7'4".
He's already in uncharted territories for the sport in our country, and he's going to be one of the best players to ever play in the NCAA.
Star athletes are coming from farther afield, too, France, Croatia, and Brazil. International players on the court during the NCAA championships. Join us tomorrow for that story. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.